portions of the text of the tower were standing there without guy wires, and it collapsed. And the local town lost the faith, rescinded their zoning permit, didn't allow them to put that tower back up again, and five people died in that accident. It's a very calculatable accident, in my opinion. When you review it, you realize that some very foolish mistakes were made. Guy wires are very important, and you make sure that you don't have any guy wire with lack of the normal tension on any side of the tower disconnected. You connect the new guy wire first before you disconnect the old one. On one of my towers, on one occasion, I replaced the guy wires. I did it myself. I made sure that the new guy wires were attached before I replaced the old one. I've heard so darn many stories of people who think that only the upper guy wires are important. The lower guy wires are the more important ones, because without them performing correctly, the tower is capable of bending off to one side, jackknifing, and collapsing. The lower guy wires are the most important ones, and those are the ones you're going to lose if you drop a very heavy tower section. So lots of people have thought over the years that articles on this subject should be written in order to propagate this piece of information so that people don't make these foolish mistakes. The problem is, no one wants to write that article. The liability risk is huge. You write an article like that, and somebody thinks that they're following your advice in the article, they get themselves in trouble, and their attorney or their survivors will sue you. So everyone's afraid to write the article, therefore the information doesn't get disseminated, and therefore these foolish mistakes happen over and over again. As I said, we kill five people in the United States every year, on average, for very simple tower erecting mistakes. Usually these are commercial people that are dying. Thank goodness the ham radio operators are not dying. Some of the things that I've seen happen at field day sites scare the daylights out of me. I've seen 30, 40, and 50 feet of tower held up with guy wires that are made out of nylon rope that goes into a stake in the ground. Well, when the stake is in the ground, not very solidly, a person walking around at nighttime can easily run into a guy wire by mistake, pull the stake out of the ground, and 30, 40, or 50 feet of steel tower could fall over and fall onto a tent with radio operators inside. I'm very happy that that accident hasn't occurred, but I've seen episodes where I think if the risk was there, because the stakes in the ground didn't have backup mechanism on the stake, they didn't have flags on the wires to make sure that people couldn't walk into them at nighttime.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Anybody have further questions or comments on all of the above? Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW on the TechNet.
K2KEY.
Bell recognized. Anyone else?
WH2RR checking back in.
Joe recognized. Bell, go ahead.
The failure of that crane in New York looked like a tower just going straight up. And exactly, you know, it seemed like it tilted away from the building. So I would assume that usually as they put these sections up, they attach it to the building. And what exactly did they say was the failure? I seem like it just, you know, disappeared, that whole situation. Nothing's ever been said other than what went on the first few days, all the publicity, you know, and all the coverage and everything about that so-called crane collapse. Actually, a crane, it actually is a type of a tower, I would assume, Dick, over.
2N.
WS2N also recognized. Yeah, that is a tower that gets constructed as the building gets constructed. Every couple of floors, an attachment is made between the tower and the level of the floor of the building at that point. The crane operating company had been given a violation notice the day before. The violation notice was that heavy steel materials were mounted too close to a floor edge on that building. The way you raise that tower along with the building is that you have these steel crisscross pieces and the steel vertical risers that are hauled up to the upper floor of the building that you're constructing. And when you want to raise the crane, you literally construct another tower section of the crane outside of the telescoping section that the top of the crane is mounted to. You construct another tower section on the outside by putting these pieces together and bolting them. The crane has got a jacking mechanism on the inside that then jacks itself up one more floor, and you add another attachment between the standing crane and the building. Okay? One of those heavy steel pieces that they had been given a violation notice the day before and had been mounted too close to a floor edge, it is my belief, from what I heard, one of those sections, one of those strong steel sections, dropped from the upper floor. It hit one of the lower connection points between the crane and the building and disconnected the crane from the building when it hit it at a, you know, at a high velocity, because that strong chunk of steel had dropped some number of floors. The crane was therefore no longer properly connected to the building, therefore it was unsupported and it fell over. That is my understanding of what the failure mechanism was. Again, very anticipatable. When you put those sections of the tower of the crane together, you have to make sure that they're properly bolted with all of the bolts properly installed. You have to make sure that every one of the connection points between the standing crane and the building are properly attached. And you have to make sure that there are no heavy materials on the building capable of being dropped in such a way that it can hit the connection points between the crane and the building. Because you disconnect one or two of those connection points and there's nothing supporting the crane. Paul, WS2N, I think you wanted to make a comment.
Okay, yeah, I read that too, that the pieces of steel that came down hit the other connecting points and broke, separated from the tower. I'm not crazy about this whole tower design that they have going up the sides of the building lately. There was another failure in Florida a couple of week or two after the New York incident. Again, I see the towers running up the side of the building. Years ago, most popular design was having the tower crane on the center of the building. And as the building went up, the crane would have hydraulics and lift itself up. But they were always mounted in the center of the building, on top of the building. And then at the end of the job, it would lower itself down piece by piece. But, you know, you want to have section after section after section. You know, you were actually connected to the steel of the building in four locations. This style that they have nowadays going up the side of the building is really only connecting two points to the building. So I'm not a big fan of that. You're grabbing loads from behind, that's okay, you know. I mean, it works, but I think you have a much stable situation if the crane is in the center of the building, mounted to the steel of the building as it goes up back to your WS joint.
Yeah, Paul, if the center of the building has an elevator shaft that's big enough that can accommodate the crane, and you build the crane up the center of the building where the elevator shaft is going to be, that's one way of doing it. But if your building doesn't have an elevator shaft in the center, and there's one other disadvantage of having the crane in the center, and that is if the building is wide enough, now the boom on your crane has to reach very far over to one side, and therefore it makes a very large bending moment on that crane. It's possible to properly handle that with the right kind of counterweighting mechanism on the crane, a movable weight at the back of the crane that accommodates the load that's lifting in the front. But now you have to balance everything correctly. You have to move the weight at the same time you're moving the boom on the crane and lowering or raising the load and disconnecting the load. So everything's got to be done in the right sequence. It's kind of complicated. The crane up the side of the building, if properly done, can be a very sturdy, very stable structure. The catch is that the people doing the work have to understand the mechanics and the physics of what they're doing. Those connection points are extremely important. The bolts that connect the pieces, the crisscross pieces of the crane together, are extremely important. There are inspections that take place where people find missing bolts or bolts that were not properly tightened because the people doing the assembly think that, it's belt and suspenders. We don't have to connect all of the points. We don't have to connect all of the bolts. Not all of them are needed. Very foolish thinking. So if properly done, and if strong enough connection points to the building are made, and the building itself is strong enough, then the crane up the side of the building is a good piece of engineering. But no matter how good the engineering of the job is, if the people doing the work cut corners and make mistakes, the best plan in the world can create a failure. A building was being assembled in New York, in Connecticut, where each individual floor had a bunch of steel girders being held to the vertical walls with bolts. Some of the bolts were not properly installed and properly tightened. The concrete was being poured on the floors, and eventually one of the upper floors, the weight of the concrete, created a failure of that floor. It pancaked down to the lower floor. The impact created failure of the next floor, and pretty soon six floors of building collapsed with a bunch of people inside, and a few people died. Again, an anticipatable accident. The connection points before you add heavy load to a floor are extremely important. I'm disappointed when I see those flanges that are in the photograph of the failed pieces of the World Trade Center. When I look at the way those bolts were connected to the wall, I realize that it was a, in my opinion, marginal design. Also, I can give you evidence of
repeater, timeout, cancel.
There was a procedure that took place in one of the floors of the World Trade Center in which the floor loading was going to be exceeded by the hardware that was going to be mounted on that floor. And so therefore, they got around the procedure by laying down another set of I-beams crisscross across the floor and then putting on the heavy load. In that procedure, when I read those reports and talked to the people who were involved, I never heard anyone describe increasing the mounting mechanisms that connected the floor to the vertical walls. And that was the weak point. The fact that they put extra crisscross bars on the floor means that the pounds per square foot of the floor loading was not going to be exceeded at that floor location. But the total weight on the floor was enough that I'm amazed the building didn't create a failure at that time. That building did have, in my opinion, a couple of built-in floors, FLAWs, which are anticipatable. The fact that you go down a fire escape and the fire escape doesn't go all the way to the street. At certain floors, you have to come out of the fire escape, walk through one of the floors, out one door, into another door, to go down the rest of the fire escape. In a panic situation with a smoke in the building, without a whole lot of practice ahead of time, you wouldn't be able to do that. That's not a good fire escape. The fire escape was too narrow so that people couldn't be going up and down it simultaneously. The sprinkler system was inadequate, and so on. A number of New York City fire laws had been violated in the construction of that building, and by some magic, the people constructing the World Trade Center, the Port Authority, were given carte blanche to violate those rules. And some of those rules that were violated, in my opinion, created some loss of life. Hopefully, the next time we build that building together, we're going to avoid some of those mistakes. Okay, Joe, I think you had a question. It's beyond 9 o'clock, so WA2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. K2RIW in the TechNet, WA2RYY. Yes, I have a question. The question has to do now with frequency measurement. And can a DTV signal off the air be used as a pseudo standard for frequency measurement?
Okay. You're going to have to tell us the secret, Joe. What is a DTV signal? Sounds like you said Baker, Papa, and Victor. What in the world is that? And by the way, Joe, do you believe in UAA?
Delta, Tom, Victor. Digital television signal. Just like you have coming out of Channel 21. Analog, the channel right next to it is digital. That's what I'm talking about.
Okay, I've been reading the manuals on digital television, and yes, there is a pilot tone. I don't know how easy it is to receive the pilot tone, but there is a very exact pilot tone being transmitted on digital television. It is my belief that you will be able to use that as a standard frequency. On an NTSC, old television, a standard that's traceable to the Bureau when you're connected to a network program is the Comenius subcarrier, 3.579545. That is traceable to the Bureau. that, but the people who really care about high-frequency accuracy, the people at cell site and the people on the microwave reflector, have for quite a few years now been experimenting with techniques of using a global positioning satellite receiver system as the raw information to discipline a, say, 10 or 100 megacycle reference oscillator. There again, by way of by the global positioning satellite receivers, you are directly connected, so to speak, to the National Bureau of Standards. So I think there is a pilot tone on the digital TV signal, according to the manuals that I'm now reading on that subject. By the way, I asked you if you believe in UAA, Joe. UAA stands for Use All Acronym. So KQRYY, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Use all acronyms, huh? Okay. So you do not know the measurement procedure of how you'd measure or what would be involved in measuring the signal components of a digital television signal that you'll rely on it for measurement purposes, correct?
Okay, as I read the manuals on the subject, the lower pilot tone is approximately 0.31 megacycles from the low end of the channel. But I'll have to double check on that. But there is an exact mathematics of where the pilot tone has to be located as far as the channel spacing is concerned. So right now I give you a 90% chance that on digital television there is a pilot tone. With the right kind of equipment, you can suck that pilot tone out of there. That pilot tone is required for the demodulator of the 8 VSD signal. It's 8 vestigial sideband is the name of the actual mechanism of digital transmission. In order for that to be properly synchronized, it needs an exact pilot tone. That pilot tone is on an exact frequency. So as you and I dig into the details of digital television, I give you a 90% chance the pilot tone is there and you can use it as a frequency reference. We just have to find out more of the details of how to do it. But pilot tone is not going to be a super strong signal that sticks out of the whole conglomerate like your carrier does on normal NTSC television. There, recognizing the carrier is very easy. On the spectrum analyzer, it's the strongest thing on a screen. In the case of digital television, the pilot tone is buried in the grass of the Bart head spectrum that you're going to see. I think you know what I mean by Bart's head. In other words, when you see the spectrum of digital television displayed on a spectrum analyzer, it looks like Bart Simpson's haircut. That's the B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Your echo mic is turned on.
Who is echo mic?
You have the echo turned on your mic. This is KC2RGW.
Yeah, I think he's speaking to you, Joe. We always hear echo in the background when you talk.
That's because if I don't have the receiver on, receiver 146.85, I can't be certain I'm not being stepped on because I'm coming into the IRLT.
Yeah, but if you wore earphones, we wouldn't hear that echo. Minor improvement there. So, I wonder if what you've heard so far with reference to that pilot tone makes sense, Joe. Go ahead.
Okay, now I turned all the other receivers off. Now you shouldn't hear any echo at all. Yes, I have measured that frequency. I have seen a carrier at 0.31 megahertz above the bottom end of the DTV signal. The only problem is the ones I've measured that are measurable in the area of about 4 or 5 or 6 of them I've been able to see on the air, they're all not on the same exact frequency. They do vary a little bit from one to another to another. That's why I was asking if it could be used as a frequency standard. Years ago, you used to be able to rely on the cellular setup channels as a frequency standard because they were good to about 1 hertz accuracy to about 1,000 meg, which is close enough for what I needed to measure. But these other signals I have found that come up as a carrier, appears as a carrier on a spectrum analyzer, and if you tune to it with a service monitor, They are not all on the same exact frequency from one to another to another. That's why I asked about the subject.
Yeah, I think the best guy you and I can get a hold of is Eric when he comes back, KE2EJ, who is the engineer for Channel 21 and Channel 13 in the local area, broadcast engineer, and as such, he will know more of those details. The possibility exists that you're listening to the early equipment setup of digital television, and that once we flip over to true digital television all the way, I'd like to believe people will tighten up those specs, so to speak. Also, when it comes to ordinary television, I believe ordinary television is allowed to be plus or minus 20 hertz from the assigned frequency, something in that order. So the exact assigned frequency you're on, you're allowed some leeway. But the spacing between the upper pilot tone and the lower pilot tone, there's a pilot tone roughly 0.31 megacycles from the upper end of the band, another pilot tone roughly 0.31 megacycles from the lower end, and the spacing between those two must follow an extremely exact formula in order for the demodulator to work correctly. That's my early understanding of the manuals that I'm reading on the way 8DS medium takes place. I own a manual on the subject, which is 400 pages long, and deep technical stuff. I haven't plowed through all of it yet, Joe, but I am interested in the subject. So the fact that you've measured some errors now doesn't completely surprise me. Roughly, what's the greatest error in frequency that you've measured to date? The B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I have seen some frequencies as much as a couple of kilohertz off either way, it seems like. It's that much. I should have collected that data because I should have known, but they probably asked me what percentage it was from that frequency. I will have that information next week, the ones I can see. I do have another question. I don't know if you're allowed to get two questions in one tech net or not, but this goes back to a couple of weeks ago. I asked one question, and you answered it simply with an answer of, it's in the magic of the software. And the question I was asking was, it had to do with using a SiteMaster.
Okay. Go right ahead with your question, because I think we've used up all the people who had questions. Oh, wait a minute now. Stand by. We do have Paul. Let me go to Paul and then come back to you. Paul, WS2N, go right ahead with your question. Oh, wait a minute. His question was on my antenna. We answered his question. Joe, you're number one on the runway. Go ahead with your question, Joe.
The question I believe I initially asked was, when you were using the load, short, and open calibrating components, calibrating on the end of a test cable, my question had to do with tightening those components to that cable by either by hand or torquing them, and you seem to, and the answer you come back with was the magic is in the software. I didn't quite answer what I was asking, actually. Are you mean to tell me that there's no difference if you put a load, a short, and an open on the end of the cable, and between hand tightening it and torquing it, are you going to tell me there's no difference in the measurement that's made to the end of that cable?
Of course, if I had said that, I was wrong. If you're trying to make measurements to the nearest 1 degree of accuracy, it behooves you to torque all of your SMA connectors to the right number of inch pounds or dyne centimeters, if you know what I mean, if you're a metric person. So tightening to the right torque on the connectors, of course, is the right thing to do. However, I have done it finger tightened on all the measurements I make. The measurements I make, I'm trying to impedance match an antenna, and I'm trying to knock down the S11 as low as I can get it. And I'm looking for numbers like minus 25 and minus 30 dB on the antennas that I'm tuning at 900 megacycles. In that case, the exact magnitude of the reflection coefficient as I'm looking for, the exact phase angle of the reflection coefficient, is not relevant to me. And so, with finger tightening, I've gotten what appears to be very repeatable results. But if you're doing exact measurements, meeting lab specifications, of course you should use a torque wrench. By the way, there are ways you can misuse the torque wrench. Depending on how you hold the handle of the torque wrench, you can get different torque settings of the exact same connector. Not many people know that. There's a prescribed way of holding onto the torque wrench when you're using it. Back to you, Joe. And by the way, are you familiar with what you're really doing when you put the short, open, and load on the end of your particular cable? And what's really going on with the so-called 12-point correction procedure that's built into almost every modern-day network analyzer? To me, 2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
To put it simply, maybe I'm wrong with this type of answer, but I'll say simply, you're taking the cable, your test cable, out of the equation.
You're absolutely right. What the machine is doing, particularly when the short circuit is there, and it knows it's going to see at the load point a essentially 100% reflection coefficient, as it sweeps through all of its frequencies, it's memorizing the phase angle of that reflection coefficient and the rate of change of that phase angle. Therefore, in theory, the program built into your network analyzer knows exactly how many centimeters of cable you've got for your test cable. Therefore, in theory, you can calibrate it from 800 to 1,000 megs, so to speak, and then decide to sweep over some region inside of that region to expand it, so to speak, and it can do an interpolation in between those points and come up with an extremely good answer. Not perfect. If you recal with the new sweep speed, with the new sweep width, you'll end up with slightly better calibration, but you still get rather good results. As I said, in my case, I'm not looking for the exact phase angle of the reflection coefficient. I'm looking for the magnitude of the reflection coefficient. And that's nowhere near as sensitive to whether or not the connector has been properly torqued on the end of the cable. When you put the short and open, the machine knows not only how long is the cable, but what is the apparent standing wave ratio of the connector that's on the end of the cable. Every cable is not a perfect device. It has a little bit of standing wave ratio at the input connector, a little bit of standing wave ratio at the output connector, and sometimes some minor perturbation somewhere in the middle of that cable. So therefore, when you sweep the cable with a perfect short circuit, you should have an extremely exact scalloped pattern of amplitude versus frequency displayed on that screen due to those reflection coefficients, even with a perfect dummy load. In reality, you're going to get a slightly more complicated pattern because on every realistic piece of cable, there is minor perturbation in more than one location. In theory, the matrix that memorizes all of that data when you do that cal procedure with short, open, and load figures out what all of that means. And so, like you said, eventually you've taken the cable out of the system. It's essentially as if you are now connecting the device of the test directly to the front panel, and assuming that the front panel is directly located at the source of the signal, that there's not even a length of cable inside of the front panel of the machine. All of that is being taken out by the cal procedure. You're really taking out the length of cable from the phase center of the directional couplers and their detectors that are buried inside of the machine. It turns out the main thing you're doing with the cal procedure, you think you're correcting for the cable. Believe it or not, the portion of the system that is least leveled is the directional couplers of
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Turns out the directional couplers that are buried inside of the network analyzer are not completely flat, do not have extremely high directivity. They're trying to cover a ridiculous number of octaves. The particular network analyzer I use starts off at 10 kilohertz and goes to 8 gigahertz. There's a tremendous number of octaves in there. To try to design directional couplers that are completely flat and have extremely high directivity over that number of octaves is out of the question. It's essentially impossible. Without the directional coupler, filling up a whole bench with all of its little correction doodads on it, which they didn't do, which would require a whole lot of hand tweaking. Instead, they build a good directional coupler, not an excellent one, not a lab grade one, not an instrument grade one. They build a good directional coupler in there and recognize the fact that the CAL procedure will take out the effects of the directional coupler, the visoir of the detectors themselves that are connected to the directional coupler, and all of the cabling from that point of measurement all the way out to your device on the desk. To be A2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thank you, Dick. I think you basically answered my question. I was had a discussion with somebody once about that, and I thought I was right with having to be using something like a torque wrench or something, or, you know, something like that to be able to put the connectors up a little stronger than just hand tight. Because I know if you turn the cable on the back of the instrument, once you have it calibrated, you have to recalibrate because your measurements will be off if you just simply think you're going to retighten the thing by hand again. There's a lot that can go on with these instruments. But I guess if you want the good, accurate measurements, you have to do things the right way. And some of these companies do require very, very stringent specs. Like if they're looking for a return loss on a cable and distance to fault, some companies expect a bump on the cable to be no more than minus 45 dB, and connectors to be no more than minus 32 as far as going in looking in a positive direction, which is pretty stringent. So that's what made me think about having the instrumentation working correctly by making the measurements using the caliper procedure correctly and tightening the components correctly to get the best accuracy out of the instrument.
Okay,
why? Very fine, Joe. Go ahead, Mel. And Mel, what's the highest frequency on a network analyzer you've been privileged to use up till now?
Well, I've used, some nice spectrum analyzers, not personally so much, but worked with the, when I used to go to that lab in New York where they used to do all the testing of radio equipment that was for procurement for a foreign government. I had that friend that ran that lab at the time, and now moved it overseas. But, and I have the, some of the, Dr. Rose, from Rose and Schwartz, the company that manufactured some of that equipment, and some of the communications equipment. What I was going to say, and that's why I was going to bring this up, actually, is to tell you that he had a very interesting torque wrench there. When you pulled on it, when you set it to the number of foot-pounds that you wanted, when you reached that, it had made a click stick at that snap, telling you that you reached the setting, which I think, I don't remember who made that wrench, but that was the best of the torque wrenches for assembly that I ever seen, to tell you the truth, Dick, over.
Yeah, very fine, Mel. I've used that exact torque wrench quite often. It's part of the calibration kit made by Murray Microwave that builds the actual calibration kits that are sold by in Ritsu, Agilent, Hewlett Packard, and Roden Short. Elric Rode, I think is the name of the guy you're talking about. I've forgotten his call letters. Somebody's going to eventually tell us. And he's got
DL4UR.
Say again, DL4UR?
No, DL4LR. LR.
Okay, that's his German call letters. He's also got, when you look up his name, you'll find out that him, his wife, his son, his daughter have American call letters. He's got a set of American call letters as well as his German call letters. He spends quite a bit of time in the States, I can tell. Anyhow, that clicking torque wrench for SMA connectors, if you study it, you realize that if you put your finger at the far end of the bar that you hold onto and operate it from there, or if you put your finger on the nearest end of the bar that you hold onto, you'll end up with two very different torques before it clicks. In fact, if you hold your finger at the very near end, I'll bet you could double the torque before it clicks. So you got to be a little bit careful in how you use it. It's a good technique, but it's not foolproof from my point of view. Whereas the kind of torque wrench that many of us use when we're tightening a socket wrench, when we're using a quarter-inch drive or a 3/8 drive socket wrench, or is it half inch drive? I've got a half inch drive torque wrench. It's got a bendable bar in the middle of it that deflects and pushes a needle across the scale. That one is a lot more foolproof in the torque that it creates. But that's a much more elaborate mechanism than you've got on that clicking mechanism on an SMA wrench, a 716th wrench. But still, torquing an SMA connector to the right wrench and a properly installed connector makes a significant difference in the integrity of the contact you get at that connector. Lots and lots of people think that each individual connector gives you half a dB of loss, whether it be type N, SMA, BNC, and whatever. Pure hogwash. Each individual connector has an amount of insertion loss that's extremely small, numbers like 0.05 dB or 0.02 dB. Each individual connector makes an impedance bump. They give you some reflection coefficient, no two ways about it. But the magnitude of the reflection coefficient and the insertion loss it creates is extremely small. For a device to create loss, real insertion loss, it has to have length and an I squared R property to it. That's the only way you make loss. Or it's got an extremely high standing wave ratio and it's reflecting some of the power back to the source. There's no other mechanism of loss. Oh yeah, you and I could design a really yucky connector that has lousy shielding and it radiates the signal into space. But among the connectors that provide reasonable shielding and reasonable standing wave ratio, like under 1.5 to 1, there is no insertion loss for each individual connector. There are loads and loads of people, let me drop, who are scared to death to put connectors and adapters anywhere into a system. They want to make sure that the transmission line that starts off at the back of their transmitter and goes up the tower has one connector in the shack and one connector with the antenna and nothing in between. You don't have to be anywhere near that severe. Properly installed connectors do not create problems. Yes, improperly installed connectors can fall apart. They can absorb water. They can have lousy weatherproofing. Terrible things can happen. They can have whiskers inside because you didn't do a good job of preparing and soldering the things together and so on. You know, a short circuit whisker between the center conductor and the shield. There's 40 ways you can install a connector incorrectly. But properly installed connectors and adapters do not have insertion loss. I've heard Saddam many times, a guy on 450 will say, gee, my brick amplifier, my Mirage brick amplifier, which used to have SO239 type connectors on it, you know, 50 ohm UHF connectors. I've replaced both of those with type N UG58 connectors, and I've therefore gotten rid of half a dB of insertion loss, and my amplifier is now going to be a dB louder. There are lots of people who believe that. That's a great leap of faith, but it's got very little to do with reality. Have we missed anyone? Of all the people who signed in who did or didn't have questions, speak up now. Give me your call letters and your name. K2LIW on the tech net.
Yes, SW2EWK.
Boy, Al. Name is Bill.
Okay, I heard Eugene and Bill. Bill, what is your call letters?
KC2SYL.
Is that Foxtrot Sierra Yankee?
Negative. Kilo Charlie 2 Sierra Yankee Lima.
Oh, I was close. Okay, Eugene, EWK, go right ahead.
Okay, W2EWK. I think I got an important question to ask you. It might sound a little silly but, you know, I scratch my head during the deal when I wake up in the morning. I heard that the TV stations use only one antenna on the building only. And it pump all the thousands and thousands of watts into this one antenna. Now, my question is to you is, when they do this, would this be a very high SWR? Be coming back to the transmitter? Please answer that, Dick, on that. If so, why can't we do the same thing over here? What can, you know, like 2 meters, 440 or 1.2, why can't we transmit into one antenna at the same time? My theory is that if we did that, one of our receivers will go bad. QSL, W2EWK.
What you said is accurate, Eugene. If I had a dual band antenna, 2 meter and 440 antenna, and I put a T connector at the feed line in the bottom of the feed line that's in the shack, and one T connector I run it over to my 2 meter transceiver, and one end of the T connector I run over to my 440 transceiver. When I'm listening, I will be able to listen to both bands at the same time. The 2 meter signal will come down that dual band antenna, go into the 2 meter receiver, and come out the loudspeaker. The 440 signal will come down that dual band antenna, go out the other end of the T connector, and go into the 440 receiver, and come out of that loudspeaker. And guys could be on both of those bands at the same time, both talking, and I'll hear both of their voices come out of those two loudspeakers. In the receive mode, I can do that. But if I now leave the 440 receiver connected to that T connector, while I start transmitting a whole lot of power on 2 meters, the 2 meter signal goes into that T connector, some of it goes up the antenna, and some of it goes over to the 440 receiver, and there's a chance that the 440 receiver would be damaged. However, if I'm smart enough to use a diplexing filter, a filter that has one output connector but two input connectors. The first input connector has got a bandpass filter at 2 meters. The second input connector has a bandpass filter only at 440. Now, by way of that filter mechanism, I can connect those two transmitters, those two transceivers, to that antenna. The antenna doesn't know the difference. It'll transmit and receive on 2 meters at the exact same time as transmitting and receiving on 440. And that diplexing filter keeps all the signals going in the right direction. The 440 bandpass filter on the right-hand side of that diplexing filter will not allow the 2 meter signal to get into that transceiver on 440, and vice versa. So with the right filter mechanism, you can do that. Every repeater does that, Eugene, stand by. In that case, you're using not a diplexing filter, but a duplexing filter. It's one which allows you to transmit and receive in the same band at the same time. Every repeater does that. You've got three cavities tuned to the 146.85 connected to that transmitter. You've got another three cavities tuned to 146.25 going into the receiver section of the repeater. But the common port of that duplexing filter goes up to a single antenna, and you're transmitting and receiving. So you can now see that with the right kind of diplexing and duplexing filters, I can transmit and receive simultaneously more than one frequency into the right antenna, into a single antenna, if the antenna is properly designed to handle those two frequencies. Once you see the principle on how I can do it with two transceivers, nothing's stopping me, if I've got the money, to do it with three, four, or five. Nothing stopping me from having five filters, five transceivers, five bands going into a trap dipole and five bands. A good trap dipole or a fan dipole can obviously work on five ham bands at once, 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10. With the right filter mechanism, I could operate on every one of those bands simultaneously during a contest. If I've got enough contest operators, I could man every one of those bands into that one antenna if I've got enough quality of all of that filtering. Without the filtering, yes, I'm going to be burning up some front ends. Now, on the Empire State Building, let me drop. There are some shared antennas. But CBS, we'll say, has Channel 2 and a couple of other channels that are CBS-owned for high-definition television coming out their antenna. NBC has a set of antennas with a bunch of frequencies going into it. ABC has an antenna with a bunch of frequencies going into it. In a couple of cases, a couple of those broadcast brand names got together and they decided to share an antenna by way of very fancy filtering. In the case of a 50 kilowatt broadcast transmitter, that filter is something that it takes a forklift to lift it, if you know what I mean. It's a big, heavy structure. I've seen some of these broadcast filters. But with the right kind of filtering, and the right kind of an antenna design, you can put almost as many frequencies as you want simultaneously into one antenna. W2EWJ, EWK, K2RIW. You got it, Eugene.
Okay, thank you very much, Zach. W2EWK.
Yeah, that's a good question, and it defies common sense until you find out the magic of what filtering can do. Now, the design of a filter for bandpass on 146.85 is not too difficult. The design of a filter for bandpass on 146.25 is not too difficult. But a combined filter sharing a common output port in such a way that it gives you full duplex capability, where you can simultaneously transmit on 146.85 while listening on 146.25. That's a much more elaborate filter. A lot more smarts is required to properly pull that off. But with the right kind of a computer program, it's doable. Okay, the next person who signed in was Bill, KC2, Sierra Yankee Lima. You got it, Bill. My name is Dick.
Thank you, Dick. I have a basic question about Echolink and IRLP. And permit me to introduce myself. I'm a new ham, received my tech license through Linemark. I took the test back in February and passed it and received my license and bought a little handy talkie. So that's what I'm using now. But I have a basic question about Echolink and IRLP. I don't know if this is the correct forum. If the computer forum is the correct one. So just enlighten me on that. Thank you.
K2QQ with a comment.
K2QQ, recognized. Bill, you made a minor error, very minor error on that last transmission. You didn't wait for the beep. And had you made a long enough transmission, you would have timed out. And since I know I'm coming back very briefly to K2QQ, I also didn't wait for the beep. But when it comes back, you wait for the beep before you start transmitting. Now, Echolink and IRLP, very appropriate questions for this net. I'm a guy who is a little bit light on knowledge of those. Let's hope that K2QQ has got some more of that spot. And we've got other people, hopefully on frequency, that'll clear up your question when it comes. K2QQ, start off with your name, sir, and tell us what your comment is. My name is Dick.
Yes, good evening, Dick. This is K2QT from Black Tango. Yeah, I used to be an engineer. I used to be an engineer in Auto Microwave. The name of the program is Touchstone for filtering design and duplex design.
Very fine, QT. Mr. QT, what is your name, sir?
Roger.
Okay, Roger, were you present at NADA in roughly 2002 when I was over there doing about 3 days worth of consulting?
I left NADA just about 3 months right after 9/11. That's when we start laying people off. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. And so Touchstone is one of those computer programs that will do that. Good piece of knowledge to know that. And it is a fairly elaborate design in order to transmit and receive simultaneously and keep all the phases and impedances just right at the common port. To build a bandpass filter is not so difficult. To do a duplexing filter is five times more difficult, in my opinion. And so, glad to know, Roger, that there is a computer program set up to do that. And for a really enthusiastic amateur, homebrewing your own duplex filter, very doable. You go to the old-fashioned AROL manual called Specialized Communications Techniques. I think it was a $10 manual from AROL, published about 20 years ago. It tells you how to homebrew a duplexing filter for 2 meters or 440 using pieces of copper and brass tubing and connectors and things like that with proper assembly procedures. It's not black magic. In other words, the design has been worked out for amateur frequencies. Broadcast transmitters have a much more difficult problem because not only must their filter do the right amount of filtering and isolating between transmitter receiver, or in that case, between the audio transmitter and the video transmitter, which are all being assembled to one antenna. All of that has to be properly isolated and summed. not only must they meet all of the isolation and bandpass characteristics and filter skirts and whatever, but they must also, across each individual bandpass, obey some very strict rules of time delay. It's called group delay distortion. In other words, the amount of time it takes for a signal to wander through the filter, whether it be the low end of the video band or the high end of the video band, that has to follow an exact formula, which represents a particular length of cable, called group delay distortion. And any deviation from that straight line characteristic representing a fixed length of cable will eventually give you distortion in the video picture where Jay Leno's face would turn green, so to speak, if you didn't do it right. So to build a filter that meets the group delay distortion characteristics, meets the skirt selectivity and rejection characteristics, meets the individual filter isolation characteristics, that's a filter. And out of curiosity, Roger, do you think Touchstone could do all of that, even meet the group delay distortion? I wonder if you think that's cranked into the program. K2, Quebec Tango, K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, Dick. K2RIW, K2CC. I don't know. I've never tried it. I've looked into that. My specialty basically was one more amplifiers. Was actually working on hot and cold load. That was my research. Hot and cold load. Trying to find the find the best circulator. So actually won the the KX and KU band.
Okay, KX and KU band, around 15 gigahertz. Healthy bit of technology required to do that. I am guessing your hot load ran at 100 degrees centigrade, the boiling temperature of water at sea level. The cold load probably ran at liquid nitrogen, 77 kelvins. And one of the designs that was used by AIO, which they originally patented, is that the nitrogen leaking off of the liquid nitrogen dewar was being bypassed through the 50 ohm load, the cold load, so that it would purge it of air. One of the problems you've got with a cold load that's running at liquid nitrogen temperatures is that oxygen and nitrogen in the air will liquefy at the temperature of liquid nitrogen, and the liquid oxygen and liquid nitrogen that gathers in the vicinity of your cold load will disturb its standing wave ratio. So purging techniques are required. I wonder if your particular hot cold load design used that technique to get rid of the liquefaction of air. K2, Quebec Tango, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2QT. Yeah, that was one of our tests, but that was not our main concern. Our main concern was actually trying to get the lowest noise figure, especially on the KA and KU band. Because, again, at the time, we had a lot of requests for the C band, and we were trying to basically find 18 to 20 degree units, which is very hard to establish, especially when you... especially if you have maybe, very uncooperative and circulating as far as the input.
Oh, yeah. You have to worry about the insertion loss of the circulator, its directivity, bandpass, the standing wave ratio. Your hot-cold load has to do an extremely good job of presenting exactly 50.0 ohms resistor with no reactance, because when you're adjusting a low noise amplifier, they tend to be an extremely impedance sensitive device. Common sense would lead you to believe that if you looked with a network analyzer at the input of the LNA and adjusted it for a perfect impedance match, you would assume you'd have maximum gain and best noise figure. With modern day gallium arsenide field effect transistors, that's very far from the truth. Maximum gain, best impedance match, and best noise figure are very different adjustment points. When you're looking for 18 degrees Kelvin, which was the arc very recently in C-band LNAs, there's a very specific impedance mismatch that the first gate of the first transistor must see in order to get its best possible noise figure. And that adjustment point only has meaning if your hot-cold noise source presents exactly 50 ohms of resistance. Probably you were looking for something like 30 dB of S11, maybe even 35 dB or 40 dB of S11 reflection voltage coefficient on your hot-cold noise source when it was at its operating temperatures. So adjusting the circulator or the quality of those loads to do that probably kept you pretty busy. Is that true, Roger? K2 Quebec Tango, K2 RIW in the Tech Man.
Oh, yes. That kept me very busy. It was at a point where I had to have meetings with Harris at the time. Hopefully that they can come up with a better circulator. But Harris decided, well, figured, well, they have other important things to do. Yeah, that has a lot to do with the device, too, how quiet your device will be running right at the input stage. And, you know, hopefully the thing doesn't run even more than, you know, 200 mils or something like that, you know. But it's very important on the input, 1.25 on the input. The output can't kind of exceed more than 1.5. And that at least is very important right there at that point to be able to achieve anything below 35 degrees Kelvin. That was about 6-7 years ago. I don't know what they have now. I've been out of the the whole thing altogether ever since 9/11. That was it. I worked in a couple more other places. I guess working as an EE, I guess is just a waste of time after that. And anywhere else that they want to hire you, at least want to hire you from temp. And I ain't going that route at all. But believe it or not, I'm dropping a bus. Put away.
Roger, with your background, I strongly recommend that the very first Wednesday of every month, you show up at Briarcliff College at 6:30 or 7 o'clock at night and attend what's open to the public, the IEEE Long Island Consultant Network monthly meetings. And if you go to the right Google site, Google IEEE Long Island Consultants Network, you will find a great group of guys who will teach you the business of consulting, particularly a person with RF experience, wireless experience, particularly antenna experience or low noise amplifier experience, with the right kind of advertising, with the right kind of a network of people, you will find work. You will find work in your area of specialty. You'll be talking to people who are kindred spirits. They've got your kind of experience, your kind of know-how, your kind of enthusiasm, and I think you'll enjoy it. I wonder if you've heard about the IEEE Long Island Consultants Network. They've been around for 25 or so years. Mr. Weedman, I'm having trouble thinking of his first name right now, is the founder of the Long Island chapter. And if you're an IEEE member and you get the monthly magazine called Pulse, you'll see the listing of their meetings every single month. By going to their website, you'll find out exactly every single month a meeting consists of somebody giving a talk as to what the industry is like or how to run a consulting business successfully. You'll be able to rub elbows with the guys who are doing it, and I think you'll find some great interest. So I wonder if you've heard about that, Roger. K2QT, I'm a member, K2RIW on the Tech Man.
Negative, Dick. I haven't heard of it. Again, as I was saying, and I've been out of it, the whole thing altogether for about the past 7 years now, and which I totally lost my whole interest in. And what's on my email, I'm getting a lot of stuff in my email from a lot of companies, but I just haven't been answering them. Because I'll be honest with you, I was just totally fed up with the whole thing. Finding out that half the product line that you were working on is getting sent to Costa Rica and any other company you're working for, and getting dipped off by the secretary and said, hey, wait a minute, not this what? Because these are getting maintained to Costa Rica. So that's the writing on the wall. It seems like every company is doing that. So at that point, I totally got out of it. But unfortunately, yeah, my health kind of took its toll. My kids are this old, so kind of like on disability right now. I'm unfortunately on dialysis for the last 4 years, so I really couldn't really get back with a full swing. K2QT, back with you.
Okay, Roger. The choice is yours, but you have a special skill that could be used in your area of specialty if you wanted to. And consulting, from my point of view, I kind of wish I had started doing it earlier. I started in the year 2000. As long as you have antenna design and wireless capability, I have more clients than I know what to do with. I turn down work. I've got more than I can handle. I'm running 3 clients right now, and as I said, it's more than I can handle. Now that I'm retired, I work 6 days a week instead of 5 days a week, but I only work half days. I'm semi-retired, as I say it, and enjoying it. I'm being appreciated. But it's a matter of the right kind of networking, and wireless engineering, RF engineering, is something that's not well taught in the schools, so therefore, properly advertised, there is a demand for that. When it comes to companies doing outsourcing, that's going on everywhere. In order to be competitive, lots and lots of manufacturing is taking place in all kinds of developing countries, whether it be Shenzhen, China, Reynoso, Mexico, the country you mentioned, Malaysia, lots of outsourcing is taking place. But still, an awful lot of the real engineering is still taking place in the United States. The design itself is being developed in the United States, but the manufacture is taking place offshore. That is the wave of the future. This is a global economy. And if you and I were running a small company,